From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. A little before 8 a.m., on the morning of April 30th, 1975, the last United States Marines left the U.S. Embassy in Saigon by helicopter as North Vietnamese forces took the city. Much of the U.S. military's force had left a few years earlier, in 1972, and the 1973 Paris Accords saw the rest pack up and head home. And while it's hard to pick a moment when the war officially ended, many choose that last helicopter leaving as Saigon fell. That makes the end of April this year the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, a somber milestone for a conflict that wounded and killed millions throughout Southeast Asia. Nearly 3 million Americans served in the war, with over a half million in the theater of combat at the high point in the spring of 1969. In the end, almost 60,000 U.S. service members were killed, and over 300,000 were wounded between 1957 and 1975, over nearly two decades of conflict. Hundreds were held captive as prisoners of war, and over 1,000 are still unaccounted for. It's hard to imagine anyone who was there was left unscathed, but it's equally hard to imagine, really imagine, how war, how boots-on-ground combat actually impacted them. I cannot pretend to know. It's not a failure of empathy. That's what veterans tell me. Whatever you've been through in your life, if it's not combat, it's not combat. There's no shortcut to understanding. And that's okay. I've never met a veteran who would wish on me or you what they've been through. The generation that came home from Vietnam faced significant challenges. They were ostracized and misunderstood. Their psychological trauma was pathologized and at times criminalized. Homelessness, substance abuse, self-harm, and suicide were all issues, but also became part of a stereotype that made finding a peaceful, meaningful post-war life difficult. And many veterans did find those lives, but with a lot of work and a lot of help, often from other veterans, through organizations like the Vietnam Veterans of America. Now, much has been said about the Vietnam War, about the geopolitics behind it, the inhumanity of combat, the questions of accountability, of human cost and historical legacy, of lessons learned or ignored. And you could do 100 shows on all of that, but this isn't one of them. No, today's show is something a bit more personal. It's a conversation with Kurt Farrison, who served two tours in Vietnam as a U.S. Marine, and many years later, joined Chapter 885 of the Vietnam Veterans of America, where he's now president. We're talking about what it was like to come home from Vietnam, to try and understand the person he'd become during and after the war, to put his life back together and help others do the same, and what the country can do better to help veterans and service members now. All right, Kurt Farrison, thank you very much for being here today. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
So I want to start, we're here to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the end of the Vietnam War, but I want to go back to who you were before the Vietnam War and ask about, just give people a sense of, you know, who was a young Kurt Farrison?
Here's the fair answer to that. I have no idea. That person is so long gone. When I was 17 years old, I have no idea who I was. I don't believe that I had probably low self-esteem, probably a standard minority coming out of a below average home in terms of finances, and not quite knowing what the heck to do. Now, this goes back to 1960, and questioning nothing because I had no concept of what it meant to question things. You just kind of, if it made you feel good, you did it. If it didn't make you feel good, you didn't do it. That's the approximate person. Smart, I was smart. I had an idealistic memory. I could read a book and probably remember it for a week verbatim. So in school, I didn't sweat taking tests, so I didn't worry about, the proverbial, oh, I'm scared type, no notification or test from the educational system because it just didn't bother me at all. But emotionally, who was I? That's probably the best I can give you.
Sure, yeah. So what led up to you going? Did you enlist?
I did. I enlisted in the United States Marine Corps August of 1960. Because in that time, there was really nothing. I mean, there was no money in my family. I'm number six out of eight children in poor African-American family in Connecticut. There was nothing to look forward to. Really not much. Get a job with the city or some menially tasked job, and you did it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
You got married and you had a house full of kids and you know what I mean? And you just did it. That was back during a time when you could actually live off of minimum wages. You could actually do it. Minimum wage, I remember my first job was 25 cents an hour.
Where was that?
You know, just because I say these things, you don't have to ask. first job I ever had was washing dishes in a bakery. So I would have these giant bakery pans. And when I came in, there was a huge mountain of them. And I'd wash them. I'd wash them all, and he would give me $2 or something, which in 1955 was a lot of money. $2.
Yeah.
A lot of money.
What city or state was this?
Connecticut.
This was in Connecticut.
Yeah, born and raised in Connecticut.
Yeah. Okay, so you enlisted. You did two tours.
Yes, in Southeast Asia.
In Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
As much as you're comfortable with, who was the Kurt Farrison who came back?
Well, that guy was confused. That guy, he had 1,000 different thoughts a minute. A lot of feelings that he totally did not understand, just totally. So. At one time, the guy actually thought he was crazy. He thought he was losing his mind because he had all of this information and desire for questions, not answers. We had all the answers. I knew exactly what was going on with me. I just didn't know why. He would work, couldn't sleep at night. I drove a semi, and I would drive for 18 hours, 20 hours. At that time, I was cheating because the logbooks were handwritten. So you would just had two books, one for if I got stopped and one that actually reflected the time that I was spending behind the wheel.
Because legally, you're supposed to stop and take
legally,
a break.
Legally, you got to take. Back in those days, you could drive 10 hours, and then after 10 hours, you had to be off the road for 12 hours. And I wasn't doing that, obviously. So, because I literally could not sleep at night. Here's someone who I didn't even know how to ask for help because I didn't know it was wrong. You know, if you got a cut on your hand, you ask for help, you say, can I get a Band-Aid or something? And you put on it. But these wounds that I was suffering from were all from the neck up. And I couldn't figure them out.
Who was in your life at that point, in terms of friends or family?
I didn't have no friends. I had no friends whatsoever, because nobody, absolutely no one understood. I had family, but I stayed away, because they wouldn't understand me. And I didn't know how to tell them who I was. I didn't know how to tell them what I was going through at that time. So I had zero friends. I had My friend was a truck. I would get in that truck and drive for hours, making deliveries of automobile parts. That was my friend.
You were telling me before we started recording this that it took you a long time to figure yourself out a little bit.
Well, it's interesting because you know when you started it, and then you know when you complete certain tasks. But it's all in retrospect. You have to look at, you say, well, okay, in the beginning, you know, there was this confused person, and then all of a sudden, this confused person figured something out. One of the first things that I figured out was this: I have to find something that I can do consistently every day. You wanna know what that was? I could take a shower and shave and be neat every single day. That's the first thing that I learned that I could do with consistency. And then I begin to build on that. I begin to add to that, you know, different tasks. And aside from working, I already told you that I worked. No problem with working. Then as time goes on, you learn how to add things to that. You go, well, if I could do that, then certainly if I take a little bit more time, I can add something else to it. I can, it's like building a foundation for a building. You realize that, oh, good. This is great the way it is today, but it's not going to support much weight. If I want to grow with this, I'm going to have to build this foundation better. So I got to add more support to it, and that's what I begin to do. I had to learn how to be who I was then. When you asked me the question, who was Kurt Farrison before he went in the United States military, United States Marine Corps, and I told you, I don't know. That's quite true. So I had to reacquire who I was. I had to reestablish who I was. That took maybe 15 years of trying to just establish who I was. Nothing else. I wasn't building anything. I just needed to figure out who I was. So it took about 15 years. And then slowly but surely, I began to add to that. I began to add things like, okay, well, if I've been successful at this, why can't I then figure out how to turn myself off? So I said, the only way you can learn how to do this is you have to look at yourself. I spent a lot of time in mirrors, just looking at myself, trying to see, not what other people seen. I don't think I really cared what other people seen. It's what I seen, because see, I looked at the image and I knew exactly what was going wrong with it. I knew exactly the problems I had. You look at me and you say, oh, well, you don't seem to have problems. And I'm going, oh, really? But I knew. I'd look at that image and I knew. So what I would do is I would then figure out, started learning how to take all my issues and spread them out thin enough so I could just start to fix them a little bit at a time. The analogy of that would be, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. You just one bite at a time, and eventually you will finish that elephant. You eat it. So that's what I did with my life, just one little chunk at a time. And when it got too complicated, I'd split that piece up into as many pieces as I needed to, just so that I could understand it when I put it back together. I could understand it.
You were telling me part of this was learning your own personal way to deal with PTSD and...
Well, I didn't know what it was, so I was learning how to be me. I didn't really learn how to be sophisticated and with PTSD maybe 10 years ago. I'm 82 years old now. 10 years ago, maybe I learned that. 10 years ago, I realized that, hey, I'm pretty cool. I know how to tell people and recognize in people the same things that I had and tell them and show them we're an ass. You know, I can show you how to get through that. One of the other things I learned about myself was I didn't like being surprised. I still don't like to be surprised. But every night that I tried to go to sleep, I had the most horrifically horrible dreams. Every single night. So you get to a point where you hate to see the sun go down. So now I'm telling myself, I'm going, you know what, Kurt, this is BS. This is the dumbest thing you've ever done, except for I smoked just cigarettes for a little while. That was the dumbest thing that I ever did, was smoke cigarettes. So I said, what is it about this? I'd wake up after getting only a couple of hours sleep. My sleep was so bad, I was down to hour and a half a night. That's all I could get. So I said, okay, Kurt, what is it that you fear the most when you go to sleep? So I said, well, it's the dreaming. This is me talking to myself, looking in the mirror. So I said, well, what is it about the dreams that bother you? I said, well, they scare me. I wake up sweating and so on and so forth. So I finally said to myself, I says, Kurt, if you walk down the street and you pass by the same house every day and a dog comes up to a fence and barks at you, how many times will that scare you? And I realized I was going, well, how many times will it surprise you? And then I kind of said to myself, I says, yeah, that's interesting, Kurt. You're smarter than I give you credit for. I said, only a couple of times. If I walk by at 5 p.m. every day and this dog runs up to the fence and barks, it's only going to scare me a few times. Because then after that, I'm ready for them. I'm prepared. Either I got a chunk of beef in my hand or something to give the animal because I know he's coming to the fence. He's going to bark every time. So I took that and I turned that into my understanding of my dreams. So now the philosophy with the dreams was simple. I said, if you know you're going to dream every damn night, then get a Coke and some damn popcorn and get in the bed and say, let's see what the creature feature is tonight. And that's how I got over that. So I got that where I could start to get some decent sleep because I realized I was going to dream. And I said, just dream. But then as time went on, now we're talking 25 years, maybe 30 years have gone by with this. And then I realized, I said, well, How do I affect this? How do I make this a better scenario? So what I've got to do is I've got to take a close look. I've got to really analyze. And then I realized after that many years, the dreams weren't accurate. My body, my mind had bounced off of the horrible pieces of this and changed them gently over the years. So now I'm looking at myself, and one of my major dreams was I'd be in a combat fight, being a fight in my rifle jam. That never, never, never happened. But somehow, way, shape, or form, my mind created that. And I would dream that every night, every single night. So I then taught myself. I says, okay, Kurt, when you get to the point where you know it's not true, just wake up. Tell yourself to wake up. To this day, if I am having a bad dream, and it's not accurate, I just go wake up. I go, this is bull, that stuff you find in the fields where the bulls are. And I wake up. Because it's not accurate, why should I stay asleep knowing that I'm living and it is really life? I'm sure you've had dreams. You know, they're real. That is literally what you're doing at that moment. So I realized that they were inaccurate. Just wake up. So that's what I do. I just tell myself to wake up. I don't pinch myself. I just go, wake up, Kurt. It's a stupid dream.
You're telling me also that you found a way, your own personal way, to deal with situations where you were triggered.
Yes. Yes. Triggering is when you begin to relive an experience in combat. Now, this you could be triggered on anything, an automobile accident, someone beat the living heck out of you and it scared you, so on and so forth. All of those are triggering things. A trigger scenario is sight, smell, touch, and sound. You hear something that reminds you, and you don't even realize it, and all of a sudden you start to relive that point that you remind you, that it reminds you of. Same thing with smell, same thing with touch, and the same thing with sound. So what I learned to do probably 15 years into being out of Southeast Asia, being out of Vietnam, was how to realize that I've been triggered. And then what I do is I go fight or flight. Fight is when you absolutely have no choice but to fight. Flight is what you do when you know damn well that you've been triggered and you're about to get so out of control that somebody is probably going to call the authorities on you, and they're going to come and they'll probably just shoot you because you're going to be so out of control. So what you do is you just get the heck out of there. You just leave and go to a place where you're comfortable with, that you can then get yourself settled down and get both feet back on the ground and realize what it was that triggered you. You can't solve a problem until you know what the problem is, until you understand it. And if it happened to you, what you just have to do is just sit down. Preferably for me, it's a place that's dark and quiet. Then I can relive every single moment of from the time that I realized that I was that I've been triggered, and I just keep going back, 1 second, one thought, one memory at a time, and you'll find it. It's there. You remember it because that's why you've been triggered. So you just have to go back and find it, and then eliminate it. It's like the erase tape on a typewriter. You realize that something happened, you made a mistake, you don't like it. You just go back. And typewriter. Nobody even knows what a typewriter is. But on your computer, if you know that you're printing something up and you're typing it in and you know you made a mistake, you just go back and hit delete. Take it out. And that's exactly what you do with when you've been in a situation and for whatever the reason is that you find yourself that you've been triggered.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break. You've been listening to our conversation with Vietnam veteran Kurt Farrison. And when we come back, we'll hear more about how he discovered the Vietnam Veterans of America organization and how he led the Wilmington chapter through the COVID pandemic. I'm Ben Schauchman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schauchman. Thanks for staying with us. We're returning now to our conversation with Kurt Farrison, a United States Marine who served two tours in Vietnam and spent decades working to adjust to a new post-war life before finally discovering and ultimately coming to lead a local chapter of the Vietnam Veterans of America.
So you went, you were telling me, a long time without knowing that there was something.
I knew there was something. I just didn't know what it was.
No. I mean, as far as the Association of Veterans.
The Vietnam Veterans of America.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
You were out there on your own. You were a veteran. You were teaching yourself this. And you told me, you know, no one really had this talk with you.
No. Let me use some bad grammar. I wasn't teaching myself. I was learning myself to how to do this. Not teach. Learn. Because I had the information in. I just had to learn how to use it. So I refer to it as I was learning myself how to survive this. Now, I haven't made anything go away. All I've done is learn how to live with it. That's what I've done. That's my success, is how to live with it. It once that's ingrained in you, it ain't going anywhere. So what you do is figure out who I am today. Your question when you asked me who that 17-year-old was when I was in high school, who the hell was that guy? Do you still know who he is? No, that guy's gone. I put that guy to bed. I put that guy to bed probably somewhere in 60, maybe by 68, 69, I realized that guy was gone. He's no longer there. So now you just got to figure, I'll start working on who you are today. So you got to build on that guy. That's why I'm so shockingly handsome now.
Yeah, because you're just listening to this. You have to take my word for it, but this is a handsome guy.
Well, I can say that. Well, they can't see me, right?
So, you know, about 12 years ago, you first came across the Vietnam Veterans of America.
Yes.
And, you know, this is here in sort of the
Wilmington area. North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so now you're the president of the chapter.
Yes.
And, you know, one of the things you were saying was that this is a space where people can go and they sort of automatically know that the other people at the table with them understand them to a certain extent.
Don't have to explain anything. You can walk in and sit down at the table and start just downloading your life. No one at the table is going to be shocked. No one at the table is going to tell you to stop. We're going to listen. And then when you're done, if you ask, can you help me? We will then start to work with you to help you get through that. And it's group therapy is what it's called. Most of the veteran organizations have group therapy. It's probably one of the most successful things to do. And the reason is because in group therapy, you're with all like people. Most psychiatrists, psychologists, most of the professionals that we work with are not combat experienced. They don't know. Now, they may have spoken with 1,000 veterans, but talking about it and living it is two separate incidents, and there's a big difference between the two. So one of the first things that I will ask a doctor, I says, doctor, are you combat experience? If they tell me no, I go, then I'm going to tell you what I'm experiencing. What I need you to do is to then take that amazing education that you have and tell me what that means. I don't need you to try to tell me what my experiences are because I already know what they are. I'm here telling you that. So, and it works. You know, you kind of set the stage for how information is going to successfully pass between the two of us. And any veteran that's listening to this now, please, if you remember nothing else, remember that. Your relationship between you and your doctor is no better than your ability to tell everything that you can to that person so that they can reflect back to you reasoning and rhymes for why you're going to what you're going to.
You also were telling me that, you know, from around 2013, you were doing these meetings and you were meeting pretty often, right? Like twice a week?
We still do.
You still do?
We still do.
And when you hit the pandemic, it kind of drove it home how important this had been.
No, the pandemic was scary as all heck. I mean, I can honestly tell you there are very few times that I'm scared. During the early months of COVID, I was scared as all heck because I realized here is something that I cannot fight. I can't defend against it. I don't care if I got a gun or if I've got a rifle or if I've got anything. I cannot defend against this. So what can I do? So what I did is I closed my chapter. We were closed for 16 months. I did not realize that it would take that long before we could open back up. Consequently, or the positive consequences of that, I don't believe I lost one single member to COVID, not one. Because I told my guys, go home, stay home, and follow directions of the that were being given out. And that's what we did. That's what we did.
All right. Well, we need to take one more quick break. You've been listening to our conversation with Vietnam veteran Kurt Farrison. And when we come back, we'll hear more about what people get wrong about veterans and how the country could do a better job of supporting the men and women who've worn a uniform. I'm Ben Schachman. You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. We're returning now to our conversation with Kurt Farrison, president of the Wilmington Area Chapter of the Vietnam Veterans of America, as we talk about what people get wrong about veterans and how the country could do a better job of taking care of them.
I wanted to ask, what are some of the things you think people misunderstand about being a veteran?
You mean veterans or people who are non-veterans?
What do you think, people who are non-veterans misunderstand about people who are veterans?
They misunderstand them. They totally, totally misunderstand that freedom is not free. They think that, well, I've been doing this all my life, and I have never had a problem with this. That's because guys like me put our butts on the line. We walked that wall so that you could enjoy this life. So people are starting to come to grips on this a lot better. You've heard the term, thank you for your service, right? Well, when I came home from Southeast Asia, they weren't telling me that. They called me all kinds of names, baby killer, and you're this, and you're just a bad, bad, bad person. Those are the people who did not understand that the very privilege that they were exercising by feeling they can say that to me was fought for guys like me. That we provided that for you. And you decide to use it however you so see fit. So the hardest thing that I recognized that people who were non-veterans was, why did we do what we did? Why did we go fight? Why did we take other lives and so on and so forth? And the reason was because we knew that if we didn't do it, eventually that encroachment on your freedoms would find its way to our front door. And then, you wouldn't have this freedom. So we chose to go out and fight for it.
In terms of the military itself, like the VA, for example, it's relatively well documented that they didn't do a great job of taking care of people after they got back.
Well, they were learning. It was a learning process. They didn't realize the multitude of things that were happening to us. Same thing with the Korean War conflict, the Second World War, and the First World War. The government just failed to realize the obligation that they had to us. I didn't volunteer to go to Vietnam. I didn't volunteer to sit on a line in Cuba during the missile crisis. I mean, I volunteered in the United States military, which in small print it said at some point you may be asked to pick up a weapon and take a life. I didn't read the small print. I just said, oh, this is a great life. I like it. It's got uniforms. I got everything I want. The consequences of that are you get inexplicitly changed. You don't even know when the change takes place. You have no clue that you've changed. The change is so drastic that you find yourself looking around and going, this place is really screwed up. Man, is this place screwed up. I don't feel like I fit anywhere. And then you realize that the only thing that's changed is you. And some of us never realize that. There are veterans out here that have never grasped that fact, that the only thing that's changed is them. So therein lies a problem. Therein lies probably the key issue to why some 18 veterans a day take their lives. And what we want to do, well, me in particular, I would love to, if I can just, If I can see them and get to them to talk to them, I may be able to delay that. I may be able to even stop it in some instances. And that's what we look forward to.
So you're, I mean, trying to do that. Your chapter is for veterans of the Vietnam conflict, but
you... No, we are for all veterans.
You're for all veterans.
We used to focus on Vietnam veterans. Quite honestly, we did. But then we realized that the need was too big. What about the guys that were in Afghanistan? What about the guys that were in, you know, other wars? We can't leave them out. That's what they did to us. When we came home, we were considered too toxic for anyone. Nobody wanted anything to do with us. None of the veteran organizations wanted to touch us. So what we did is we built ourselves a network called the Vietnam Veterans of America. We are right now the most successful post-war organization ever. Better than 65% of benefits that all veterans get are directly because of the Vietnam Veterans of America. Those guys that when we first started coming home in the mid-60s, mid to late 60s, nobody wanted to touch. Because we have people in the halls of Congress and in the House who are constantly knocking on doors, constantly working diligently to get benefits and to get things covered. Agent Orange is one of them. To burn pits in Afghanistan was another incident that the United States government says, "Oh no, we don't want that's we don't want anything to do with that. That's your problem. You fix it." I said, "No, it's not. It's not our problem. You sent us there, so you have an obligation to us." And that's pretty much the philosophy of getting people in position of authority to recognize and to want to give us benefits for.
When you talk to younger veterans, are they willing to open up? Do they accept what you have to offer? Are they kind of standoffish at first? How does that play out?
No, you know what? The funny thing about that is that, remember I told you, PTSD, no matter who it is, no matter how you got it, is almost identical. So therefore, they know. You know when you're in the right place. Hmm. Nobody has to tell you that. When I came into the Vietnam Veterans of America right down on Princess Street for the first time, I told you, I knew within 30 seconds I'm at the right place. This is where I'm probably never going to walk out of. So talking to younger veterans, they look forward to talking to us. You know, we're the old guys now. I remember, you know, back in the day when everywhere I went, I was the youngest guy. Now, pretty much everywhere I go, I'm the oldest guy. And the younger veterans appreciate that because they know that when I tell them something, they know that I'm not just pulling it out of air. I'm not just making it up. I'm sharing with you an experience. I'm sharing with you a proven fact. I know this. How do I know this? Because I did it. And I know it works because I'm making it work every single day, every day. I don't get the luxury of saying, you know what, I'll take today off. I'm not going to worry about PTSD. I'm not going to worry about anything today. I'm just going to just footloose, fancy free. Well, that's bull crap. I can't do that. Every minute of every hour, of every day, of every week, of every month, of every year, I have to stay focused on it. I have to be totally aware of every single thing around me, every movement, every sound, every smell. I have to be aware of. That's PTSD. That's who I am today. I don't fight that guy anymore because that guy's gotten me out of more jams than you can imagine. That most people will not even, they go, I didn't even realize that was going on. I go, well, I did, you know. Even here in your studio, you gave me an opportunity to sit in one of three chairs. You see what's behind me? And I will do that 99.9% of the time. If I got an opportunity to put a wall behind me, that's what I'm gonna do. I do not like the thought that there is someone looking at me and I can't see him. you hear me reference me, but what I'm really talking about is all combat veterans. All of us are the same way. All of us. PTSD in everybody has the same range of issues that it presents itself in all of us. So, you know, different combinations of the same issues.
Yeah.
That's it.
You were talking about you know, people who will now say thank you for your service, or that the through a long decade after decade after decade of lobbying, you've gotten benefits for Agent Orange and for burn pits, and each war will bring more of that. I mean, you called it a learning process. How are they doing, do you think?
When you say they, who are we referring to?
Well, let's start with the government, with the Department of Defense and the VA. How are they doing? If you had to give them a grade.
I'm going to have to I may have to take the fifth on that question, because I'm going to tell you right now, everything I say is somehow, way, shape, or form being listened to. Let me just say this. They could be doing a lot better, all right, without.
Fair enough. No, that's fair enough. What about the general public, not the powers
general
that be?
General public is doing good. That's why they're even children come up to me, because I always wear the hat some. And they, oh, thank you for your service. Thank you for this. Thank you for that. I'm talking about 5-year-old kids who do that. Now, they're probably, in most cases, mimicking their parents from what they've seen. But that's great, because it builds from somewhere. You have to build that. So when they take that with them into their adulthood, they then teach their kids the same thing. That when they say thank you for your service, they're recognizing that freedom ain't free. Somebody has to pay for this freedom. Somebody has to walk that wall for this freedom. And anybody you see wearing an acknowledgement of his or her service to the country should be thanked. Should be thanked.
If there were things you could change about how veterans are treated these days, what would you change?
That's a good question. The thing you want to do is you just want to make, you know, life better. You know, the only way to not have problems is to don't have wars. And I think you and I are smart enough to realize that ain't going to happen, right? But there's always going to be war somewhere. And when men and women are involved with that war, there's going to be PTSD, period. So the government should be able to recognize the issues that their soldiers, their people who they gave orders to defend that hill. Go take that hill, defend this wall, do whatever you have to do to keep our country safe. Well, gosh darn, you should continually have services and benefits that you offer them when they come home, because we come home broke. We come home in pieces, and somebody has to help us put it back together, you know, so that we can understand it and that we can survive. Other than that, it's just going to be a constant drain of veterans that take their lives. So, to answer your question, I think that the federal government should react much faster to the needs of the veterans when they come in. They should not waste time. Let's not make them fight a war physically and then come home and fight the war just to get benefits, just because I got issues, or I lost my arm, or I've got diabetes from Agent Orange or something, and then you don't want to help me? Come on, give me a break. So if there's such a thing as what would I change? That's what I would change. I would say, let's do this immediately, or let's not make any more wars. let's just not have wars anymore. And then this problem would eventually go away.
Is there anything else you would want to say on this particular occasion?
I do. This is the 50th, the final pieces of the 50th anniversary. The 50th anniversary of the Vietnam War. I want to say, you know, guys, hang in there. You know, we got a lot more living to do. There's a lot more things that we'll be able to accomplish. We just got to hang in there. Learn from each other. You know, don't be afraid to ask the hard question. If you got an issue, don't be afraid to ask for help. It's that simple. You can't necessarily solve it yourself. I got lucky. I was able to solve a lot of things myself. But I don't want to gamble on that with other people. There's knowledge out here now. There's a lot more information that's available than there was in 68, 69. A lot more. The Chapter 885, Vietnam Veterans of America, in Wilmington, North Carolina here, we need help. And that help has to come in the form of finances. The only way that we can successfully wager war, maybe that's a poor choice of word, but wager a successful defense against issues that veterans have, is we have to be there. We have to stay open. We have a budget of about maybe $45,000, $50,000, you know, between the scholarships, the things that we like to do to enhance our community. And the only way that happens is folks like you all who are out listening, you just call me up. My phone number is area code 203-515-0034. That is my personal cell phone. And if you need help, you call me up and I will find a way to get you help. If you are in a position to then make financial donations to the organization, I will always accept those. And what that does is that keeps us in business, that keeps us around so that we can constantly try to solve the issues that veterans are having with their experiences. That's pretty much the end of it.
All right, well, Kurt Farrison, thank you very much for being here today.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
All right, well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Newsroom. Thanks to my guest, Kurt Farrison, president of Chapter 885 of the Vietnam Veterans of America. And we'll have some contact information for Farrison and the Wilmington chapter on the show page. Thanks also to friend of the show, Derek Anderson, for connecting me with Kurt. If you or a loved one are a veteran in crisis, you can also call 988 and press the number 1. You can also text 838-255 or go online to veteranscrisisline.net. You don't need to be enrolled with the VA or have healthcare coverage to connect. And again, we'll have links to those resources on the show page. Technical support for today's show was provided by WHQR's Ken Campbell, and music for this episode came from If These Trees Could Talk and Blue Dot Sessions. If you missed any part of this program, you can find it at whqr.org or get it as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. If you have comments, concerns, or just an idea for a future show, email us at newsroom@whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.